Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. As you can tell, very special episode of Catholic Answers Live, because that music means it's time for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, which is a fun Friday thing we get to do from time to time. I love that music, but I love what it portends as well, because what people do is they respond to Jimmy's requests for weird questions for the show, and sometimes they just send us weird questions because they know that we use them, and then Jimmy gets them organized for me, and off we go, having fun with weird questions. So this is one to listen to. We won't be giving out the phone number, at least not on purpose today. But as I said, always a lot of fun because these are pre-screened for their weirdness level, and they will be weird. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Jimmy Akin, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett. How are you doing?
I am very well. And usually on Thursday, I ask you what's dropping tomorrow, but it's a Friday. So what has dropped today on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Today we have an episode on the Knights of the Golden Circle. They were a secret society here in America that had a bunch of ambitious plans, some of which they achieved. They were active before and during the American Civil War, and they are connected to a bunch of other conspiracies that I'll be examining in future episodes. So this is kind of a foundational episode. Talks about who the Knights of the Golden Circle were, how they started, what we know about them, and at least the public story of how they ended. But there's a question about, did they really end? Were they connected to other mysterious events of the time? And do they even exist today?
Oh, what? There could be Knights of the Golden Circle today.
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay. So so you said it started before the Civil War, but was active during the Civil War?
Yes. Its major period of public activity was in the 1850s. And then once the Civil War started, the Knights continued to be active on the Confederate side primarily, although they did have supporters in the North. And they largely shifted many of their efforts to fighting the Civil War. But there are questions about exactly what they did during the war and afterwards.
How interesting. It's also interesting how the medieval idea of knights organizations persisted and other people take that up.
Yeah, well, knights were a big thing in the 19th century. The writings of Sir Walter Scott, like Ivanhoe, popularized the chivalric ideal of knighthood.
Right.
And some people even think that that played a role in the revival of the idea of chivalry, and knighthood may have even played a role in the coming of the Civil War. But you did get bunches of groups that styled themselves as knights, not just the Knights of the Golden Circle, but the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan and the Knights of Columbus, among others.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it was a 19th century revival of the romance of the knight, huh? After Ivanhoe.
Yeah.
I've got to read Ivanhoe then. I've never read Ivanhoe.
Mm-hmm. It's about knights.
I gathered as much, Jimmy. I gathered as much. Maybe I'll get motivated and start my own knightly organization. I almost gave out the number. No number today because it's Jimmy Akin's Mysterious. No, Jimmy, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, which that's connected with Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Sometimes you do weird questions over there. Mm-hmm. And, well, pretty much every week you do something weird, or at least unusual. This one comes from Eric, Jimmy. Would it be logically possible for God to create a universe with multiple dimensions of time? What would such a universe be like, and how would we perceive it?
So as to the first question, would it be logically possible? Logically possible just means, do the terms contain a contradiction? And there is no contradiction in the proposition of a universe that has more than one time dimension, any more than there is a logical contradiction in the idea of a universe that has more than one space dimension. And so it certainly would be logically possible for God to create a universe with more than one time dimension. In regard to the second question, what would such a universe be like? That would depend on how God created it. It would depend on the number of time dimensions he gave it and how those time dimensions relate to each other. In our universe, we at least perceive time as a continuous flow. And we pretty much perceive space the same way. You know, it's you don't perceive any units of space.
Yeah.
That are intrinsic to space itself. You can just move through space freely, and we flow through time freely. But it doesn't have to be that way. There is a kind of geometry, sometimes called taxicab geometry, where you have discrete units of space or time, like blocks in a city that taxicabs have to drive around. So if you imagine going on a diagonal path in a city made up of square city blocks, there's no way a cab can travel a direct path, because the cabbie would run into buildings. So instead, he's got to make a bunch of turns around different blocks to accommodate the different buildings. Well, it's proposed, not by any means proved, that we actually have that in our universe, that space and time are both made of irreducible units or quanta. And this is sometimes called, these units are sometimes described in terms of what's known as the Planck length and the Planck time. If so, they are so small that we don't perceive them. And so we don't have the experience of traveling diagonally by making a bunch of turns in either space or time. We perceive ourselves as being able to move freely. But it's possible God could make big blocks that we could perceive, in which case in order to move diagonally in a room, we'd have to make a kind of zigzag pattern to get to the other side of the room in a diagonal fashion. And the same thing could be true of time. So in answer to the second question, what would it be like and how would we perceive it? The answer would depend on the nature of the time dimensions and how they relate to each other, depending on how God chose to make that universe.
That is hard for me to think about, but you did make it approachable. But that's a tough one, Eric. Thanks very much for the question. That qualifies. That's a weird question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. We got lots more weird ones to come. This one comes from Drew. If a baptized person's heart or other organ is transplanted into another non-baptized person, does the organ from the baptized body transmit its baptismal graces to the new body?
Okay, so let's think about what comes with an organ transplant when you have an organ transplant. Obviously, the physical organ itself comes across. So if you have a heart transplant from another person, you now have that person's physical heart. Would anything else come with the heart besides just the physical organ? Well, there is some evidence that something might. There are accounts, and I haven't researched this in detail yet, but there are accounts of people who have received organ transplants acquiring memories or preferences from the donor. And so it's possible that something could, besides just the physical, could come across with the organ. There is, and we're in weird territory here, and I'm not saying any of this is real. I'm just describing the reports and some theories that could account for them.
Okay.
There is a reported psychic functioning known as psychometry. And psychometry is the ability to psychically detect impressions based on touching a physical object. So like if you gave me a pair of car keys and I was a psychometrist, I could hold the car keys and pick up impressions of what the owner of the car keys was like. And this could be related to a phenomenon that's often reported in ghostly literature, which is what's known in parapsychology as hauntings. A haunting is not believed to be the actual appearance of a departed human soul. That's a ghost. That's an apparition. Instead, a haunting is a kind of phenomenon that plays itself out repeatedly without much interaction. Like you see a figure walking down a staircase. And that's basically all the figure does. It just walks down this staircase, doesn't really do anything else. The theory is in parapsychology is that's not actually a departed spirit, because it doesn't interact. It doesn't behave like a spirit. It just does the same thing over and over again. So it's like a recording. And the idea is that hauntings are place memories. They're just recordings that were psychic recordings that were left by someone when they were still alive. And maybe they walked down that staircase a bunch when they were still alive, and so they left a kind of psychic imprint on that object, on that staircase. In which case, perceiving the haunting is kind of like using psychometry. You have an object, the staircase, that has a psychic impression on it.
Got it.
And people are picking up on that psychic impression and seeing the person descending the staircase. So if all of that turns out to be real, if psychometry is real, if hauntings are real, then you could, since you carry your heart around with you all the time, leave psychic impressions on your heart or on other parts of your body that might then be picked up if you then donate that organ to someone else. So that would be one possible explanation for how something non-physical could come across to the donor or to the recipient of an organ donation. Now, what about souls? Well, we have to then talk about what souls are. And the Catholic Church has infallibly defined that the intellectual soul is the form of the body. It's what integrates the body, makes it alive, things like that. But there's a question of, are there subsidiary forms within the body? According to St. Thomas Aquinas, the answer is no, that there's just one form for the whole body, and that's the intellectual soul. But not everyone agrees with that. In the view of John Duns Scotus, who was, say, a generation after Thomas Aquinas, the body has multiple different forms. Like there would be a form for your heart, a form for your liver, a form for your kidneys, and that's what makes it a heart, a liver, or a kidneys. It's got its own form that makes it the living organ that it is. In that case, if Scotus is right on that, then when you receive someone else's organ, it would come with its own form. And that form itself might be something that could carry the psychic imprint that would contain the memories or things like that. However, what you're not gaining is the overall form of that person's body. You're not gaining their overall soul. That does not come with the organ. I could give you a kidney, for example, because I've got two, at least I assume I do, most people do. I could give you a kidney and you would now have my kidney and you might have the form of the kidney that I gave you, but I'm still alive. I've still got my own soul. You're not getting my overall intellectual. So, and it would seem that baptism applies to the overall person, to the overall soul, the intellectual soul, and therefore baptismal grace would not come with the with, even if there is a subsidiary form of like a heart, if you transplant a heart, it wouldn't come with the overall intellectual soul, and thus it would not bring the graces of baptism with it. And so if the recipient of the heart of a baptized person was himself unbaptized, he would not have baptismal grace and would need to be baptized himself.
Ah, what a great question. I'm sure that many people who are considering giving their organs are grateful for the question. Thank you very much, Drew.
Yeah, by the way, I wouldn't recommend giving hearts because, at least currently, the way the technology works, in my view, they have to kill the patient to get the heart.
Oh, they got to keep you alive in order, so to speak, in order
I see. I would say you're not actually dead when they take your heart. So I am not a heart donor.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. Maybe we could talk about that. Have you written anything about that or?
I don't think I've written. I may have briefly written about it, but it's been a long time.
All right. More weird questions coming up for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What a great grace it is to have the opportunity to use the airwaves for the honor and glory of God, to be able to talk to the hearts of individuals and meet them where they are in their relationship with our Lord, and also to encourage them forward.
Women of Grace with Johnette Williams, this morning, 3 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. That's a little bit of weird music. Very nice music, actually, but of a weird variety that lets you know it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live. We're not taking calls. We've got the weird questions here, and I'll just ask them of Jimmy, and then you get to hear the answers. Already a couple of very interesting ones, and this one here comes from Chris, who says, did the Lord's death atone for persons from alternate realities?
Well, we don't know, because we don't know if there are alternate realities, but let's suppose that there are. Let's suppose there are parallel universes. It could be that they are all branching off of an original timeline. And it's hypothetically possible they all could have branched off since the crucifixion. In that case, Jesus would be dying, you know, in 33 AD, and then if timelines start branching off of that, presumably the effects of his redemption would flow down through all of those timelines, because he's in the history of each one of those timelines. And so that's one possible way it could work, but it could work other ways. Suppose that instead of branching timelines, there are just other universes that don't branch, that have just always been there.
Right.
Well, what we can say in that case is that his atonement was sufficient to cover the sins of anybody in any universe, because he's the infinite Son of God, and therefore his sacrifice on the cross has infinite value, and it therefore cannot be exhausted by the sins committed in other universes, so it's sufficient to apply to them. The question would then be, would God choose to apply the death of Christ to people in other realities? And the answer there is, that's up to God. We don't know the answer to that unless God tells us. It is possible that he could apply the grace of Christ's crucifixion to people in other realities, even if they didn't know about Jesus. But it's also possible that he could choose to do something else. He could choose, for example, to have Jesus incarnate in other realities and die there in order to provide redemption for them in a more vivid way that they would be aware of. Because if Jesus, you know, dies in our reality, they don't have any native way of knowing that. But God chose to make a vivid demonstration of his justice and mercy in our timeline. And that's not for God's benefit. He doesn't need to demonstrate his justice and mercy to himself. He already knows it. But by having Jesus die on a cross for our sins, he demonstrated his justice and mercy to us for our benefit. And therefore, if there are people in other universes, and if there are other universes, and if there are people in them, and if those people are in need of redemption, it could make sense for God to demonstrate his justice and mercy to those people as well. And one way of doing that would be to have Jesus incarnate and redeem them as well, perhaps by crucifixion or perhaps by something else.
Another fine question, and fit the description perfectly. Another nice, weird question. This one, I believe, is a reference to a BBC television program. Cynthia asks, do Time Lords go to heaven?
Well, I think it would depend on the Time Lord. I mean, you know, unless he repents, I wouldn't hold out a whole lot of hope for the Master going to heaven. Probably not the Ronnie either. She's just a psychopath. But I would have hopes for the Doctor and the Meddling Monk. They seem, you know, the Meddling Monk is mischievous, but he's not fundamentally bad. And the Doctor is positively good. So I think it's going to depend on the Time Lord. Now, that's assuming that Time Lords have a supernatural destiny, that they're called to be with God. What we can say is, and according to Catholic theology, and this is not doctrine, this is theology, which means it's in the realm of opinion. But according to Catholic theology, at least the common understanding of Catholic theology, God did not have to create rational creatures with a supernatural destiny. He could have created man in what's known as a state of pure nature, in which case man might have, for example, lived forever on earth in happiness and just not had the supernatural calling to be with God spiritually in heaven. That's at least possible, because the idea of heaven is a grace. It is something that God chooses to give us. It is not something we have a right to by our very nature. So just because you're a rational being doesn't mean you have a supernatural calling to be with God. And that could apply to the Time Lords or any other intelligent species. They would be rational creatures like us, but it might or might not be God's will to give them a supernatural vocation to be with him. However, based on the precedent of him giving that vocation to us and him giving that vocation to the angels, who are also intelligent, rational beings, my suspicion is that he would give such a vocation to Time Lords and to other rational creatures of his. And therefore, I would suspect Time Lords would have the possibility of going to heaven. It would just depend on the individual Time Lord of would they make it in all likelihood.
Yeah, all right. Thanks, Cynthia. Thanks very, very much. Just a clarification, Jimmy, because you often hear people say, you know, our rational soul, they associate the rational soul with immortal life and with a supernatural destiny. But you're saying it does not have to be associated. That's just
correct.
How it is, but logically it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, so there are a couple of issues to clarify here. The first one is, what does a rational soul do for you? Does it enable you to survive death or not? Well, we know that we do survive death, and a common theological opinion is that you need a rational soul to survive death. That was Aquinas' opinion, for example. However, that is not a universal opinion in Christian history. There have been Christian figures in various ages of Christian history, not just the modern age, but in prior ones as well, who have talked about the possibility of not needing a rational soul in order to survive death. And there has been Christian speculation on the possibility of animals having an afterlife, even though they don't have rational souls. And surprisingly, we actually have some empirical evidence to support that claim. There is empirical evidence that was discovered in the 20th century that could support the idea of animals, or at least some animals, having an afterlife. If you want to hear about that, you can listen to episode 203 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on Animal Afterlife. You can find it by going to mysterious.fm/203. So you may or may not need a rational soul to survive death. But even if you have a rational soul, and even if you do survive death, that doesn't mean God's going to say, hey, come on back to my place. You know, come on up here to heaven and be with me and have the beatific vision of me for all eternity. God doesn't have to pull you up to heaven. That's a gift. And so because you have a rational soul doesn't mean you have a destiny to be with God. God chose to give that give that as a gift to our species, but it's not essential to the rational soul. And at least according to the common Catholic theological opinion historically, God could have chosen to create man in a state of pure nature without any supernatural gifts like a vocation to heaven.
Oh, fascinating. Very important distinctions. You just often hear the soul talked about without those distinctions being made. I mean, I think that's maybe just, I don't know where we get that habit, actually. But associating all the qualities of our soul as if they're all necessary, that's kind of a habit of mind maybe that we have. That is a very fine question, Cynthia. Time Lords, of course, having to do with Doctor Who. I don't know if you ever mentioned that, just in case anyone was listening and didn't know about Doctor Who.
Time Lords are out there in popular culture. Lots of people know about Doctor Who or other Time Lords. There's even a rumor that I might be one, but I can neither confirm nor deny. No. So I have to give the Glomar response.
The Glomar response. Hey, well, have you done the Glomar Explorer on Jim Yankee's Mysterious World?
Not yet. But that's where that non-denial denial comes from.
Right back with more weird questions. What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horne took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
As a child, the great theologian Thomas Aquinas asked, "What is God?" Best-selling author Kevin Vost's new book follows the mature thought of Aquinas in answering that question. In clear and approachable fashion, What is God examines God's attributes and considers questions about him that have vexed mankind for centuries. Order your copy of What is God today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Just discussing the Glomar Explorer during the break, because Jimmy gave the Glomar response. I can neither confirm nor deny. If you don't know the story about the Glomar Explorer, it's a fascinating story, and I don't know that anyone's made a movie out of it, and I would love to see that movie. You can just look at it. Glomar is G-L-O-M-A-R, the Glomar Explorer. It's a fascinating story involving nuclear missiles and Howard Hughes. This next question, it's weird questions with Jimmy Akin, by the way, weird questions today, and we've got a whole bunch of them, and this one comes from Jesu Maria, and he asks, do Catholics believe in the presence of marine spirits? I watched a Protestant YouTube video on this subject. I never saw an exorcist even mention marine spirits in their discourses on exorcism.
Okay, so we should talk about what marine spirits are believed to be. They are not part of Catholic teaching, and they are not a received part of Catholic exorcist lore. Where they come from is charismatic exorcist lore. You have a bunch of deliverance ministries in the charismatic movement in the Protestant community. That's why the Jesu Maria mentions watching a Protestant YouTube video because it's in the charismatic Protestant community that you hear about these.
Okay.
But the basic idea, and there will be variations on this because it's going to depend on the charismatic exorcist or author that you're talking to, because they don't have a standard doctrine when it comes to this. There are going to be variations on this. But basically, the idea is that that there is a certain class of demons that has an affinity for water. And that's why they're called marine spirits. And these, this kind of demon, according to the story, will, affect people and needs to be driven out just like other kinds of demons. And so basically, this is a subclass of demons that has a special affinity for water. Well, why might you believe such a thing? Well, you might appeal to evidence that emerges in exorcism and deliverance ministries. You know, like if you're exorcising a demon and the demon is like really into the idea of water, and you find a bunch of demons like that, you may say, huh, seems like some of these guys are really into water, so we'll call them marine spirits. But that doesn't appear to be the evidence that's cited, at least not that I'm aware of. I'm aware of attempts to use biblical evidence to support the idea that there are marine spirits. And so, for example, you know, what Bible passages might you think of in that regard? Well, there are certain passages in the Old Testament that refer to creatures like Leviathan that live in the water, or that are depicted as living in the water. And if you think, and Leviathan is often understood as being a kind of sinister, threatening, dangerous thing. And so that you might say, well, that's a demon. And so this is a Leviathan could be a demon that lives in water. Also, Jesus, in talking about in one of his parables, talks about a wicked spirit being driven out of someone, and it wanders alone in a desert place, and then decides it doesn't like being in the desert place and comes back to live in the person again, and brings seven other spirits even worse with it. And so advocates of marine spirits will say, see, this demon in this parable doesn't like the desert place. It doesn't like dry, arid conditions. It likes wet, watery conditions, so it wants to go back and be in the person. And of course, people are mostly water. There's also the incident with the Gadarene demoniacs, where the demons ask Jesus to put them into the pigs, and then the pigs rush down into the Sea of Galilee and drown. And so they interpret that as the demons want to get back into the water. And so you put things like this together, and you can kind of cobble together a case for a water affinity demon that you can call a marine spirit. The problem is that all of these proposed evidences are extraordinarily weak. In the first place, Leviathan is probably not a demon. Leviathan is probably a monster, not a demon. And Leviathan may be an animal. It's been proposed, for example, that Leviathan might be a crocodile or maybe a hippopotamus. It could be an animal, but it's probably a monster from ancient Near Eastern folklore. And it's likely based on dinosaurs, because people have been finding dinosaur bones all throughout human history. We didn't find the first dinosaur bones in the 19th century. People have been finding them for as long as there have been people, because a cliffside will slough off at times and there will be a dinosaur skeleton there. And people will say, bones of an enormous animal.
Right, right.
There must have been monsters here in the past. And there were. And today we call them dinosaurs. But they didn't have that word in the past. So they just thought, that's a big monster that used to live here.
Yeah.
And so that it's the discovery of dinosaur bones. And there have actually been some fascinating books written about this. One historian who studied this phenomenon very carefully is named Adrienne Meyer. And she's written books like The First Fossil Hunters and several others where she talks about ancient discoveries of dinosaur bones and what they led to. St. Augustine, for example, in his writings, talks about finding an enormous tooth from some pre-human creature. He thought it, if I recall correctly, it may have been explained to him as this is the tooth of a human giant because it looked kind of like a human tooth. But you know, Augustine's finding fossils and writing about it. And it's probably the discovery of dinosaur bones that led to the legends of dragons. Mm-hmm. That's probably why we have dragon myths in Europe and in Asia and places like that, because the natives found dinosaur bones and dinosaurs look kind of like dragons. Mm-hmm. So that's probably where the dragon legends come from. And so Leviathan is probably one of those. It's probably a folkloric monster in ancient Near Eastern folklore that's based on the discovery of dinosaur bones. It is not a literal demon. Now, what about the demon that doesn't like being in the desert place? Okay, Psychelet, think about the word desert.
Mm-hmm.
Does desert sound like any other English word you might think of? And I don't mean dessert.
Oh, you knew I was going there, Jimmy. You knew I was going.
I don't mean the thing you eat at the end of dinner.
Yeah.
Like what?
Deserted?
I mean, deserted. Yeah, very good. That's exactly it. And that's where desert comes from. The term desert does not mean dry, arid place. It means empty, deserted place with no people.
Yeah.
And that is what the spirit in the parable is objecting to. It doesn't like being in this lonely, deserted place. It wants to go back and have a habitation, just like humans don't like being out in a deserted countryside and having to live out there. They like to live in houses. And so the demon wants to go back and live in the person as if the person were a house. It doesn't want to be in a deserted place. So that also doesn't really work as a support for a special water-loving class of demon. Then there's the Gadarene incident, where the demons go into the pigs and the pigs rush down into the sea. Well, one of the things demons are known for is torturing whatever they're in. That's what they do. They get their jollies by afflicting suffering on people, and consequently, that's the plausible explanation for why the pigs rush down into the sea. The demons don't ask Jesus to, hey, let us go down into that sea.
Right, yes.
That's what they might do if they really wanted to be in the water. They don't. They know Jesus is going to kick them out of a human. So they look for the next best thing to live in. They say, oh, let us go live in those pigs instead. They want to live in the pigs, and they want to torture the pigs, just like they were torturing the Gadarene demoniacs. So Jesus lets them go into the pigs. They start torturing the pigs, and the pigs have a fight-or-flight reflex. They can't fight the demons. They don't have the resources for that. There are no porcine exorcists. You know, none of the pigs know how to drive out demons. And so since they can't fight, their flight reflex is triggered and they rush down into the sea and drown themselves in an attempt to escape the demons. So when you look carefully at the different biblical passages that are proposed to support the existence of marine spirits, none of them are good evidence. And so this is really what we see here. Also, I would mention, why would demons care about water? They're non-physical beings.
Yeah.
You know, why would they care about water at all? They don't have biological processes that use water. They don't get thirsty. There's no obvious reason why demons would care about water one way or another. What they care about, they're intellectual creatures. What they care about is other intellectual creatures like God and humans, and in this case, you know, demons, pigs. The pigs at least have a rudimentary intellect, even though they're not rational. And so so there's no reason for a demon to care about water. And so it looks like what we have here is a kind of folk process mythology or folklore that comes up with this idea, even though there's not a good evidential basis for marine spirits.
I had never even heard of them. That was fascinating, Jesu Maria. Thank you very much for the question. It does bring us, however, to our break. We got to take that break. We'll be right back with more weird questions on this Friday afternoon with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, because I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics, tomorrow night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Television and Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And on Fridays, in general, we'll try to do something that's got a little bit of a twist to it, a little bit of fun, or in some other way, unusual. And among the most fun things we get to do is Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, where people submit their weird questions. And I have to say, sometimes people just will send me, "Ask Jimmy this," and it's a weird question. Like, people have gotten used to this. So that's
And I keep a log. When people email me or I get a forwarded message from Catholic Answers for weird questions, I keep a log. I log it, and then we use it on one of the future shows, typically the next one.
And the part of the reason we've talked about this before, part of the reason we ask for the questions in advance is that if we do the show live, many people will ask questions that are not very weird. Like, or they have a very low weirdness threshold. We have a high weirdness threshold. It's got to be weird to make it on weird questions. Like, for example, just because it's an eschatological question doesn't make it a weird question. But if it's a scatological question, as our next one is, it might make the cut. So not eschatology now, scatology. This comes from Philip. A question came up on the Clerically Speaking podcast. Is there pooping in heaven? It appears eating is in heaven after the resurrection. But is the waste of our meals due to the fall, or will it persist into eternity? And then Philip asks this, is that weird enough for you?
Yeah, I guess no. So. he wants to know, is the product of waste, because what happens when we eat is we extract nutrients from the food that we eat, but not all of what we eat is nutrients. And for example, dietary fiber is not nutrients. And so the dietary fiber, we're not capable of digesting it. We don't have the right enzymes for it. And so the dietary fiber will be left over, as will other things, because we're not perfect machines. We can't extract all of the nutrients that are in the food. And so we're able, that's why waste is a good fertilizer. It's used as to fertilize fields, not just human waste, but bovine waste and other forms of waste. It gets used historically as fertilizer because there's still nutrients in it. You know, we may eat it, or a cow may eat it and then poop out the waste, but they've only been able to extract some of the nutrients. There's still a lot of nutrients in the poop, and that's why you can use it to fertilize fields, because plants can then grow and extract those nutrients. So we're not perfect nutrient extractors, and that's one of the reasons we have waste left over. So this is a natural this is not a result of the fall. It's a result of chemistry. And therefore, it is natural if you consume food, then and you're a human, you will have waste. That's just nature. That is not due to the fall. It's like Aquinas talks about death being the concept. He didn't have the concept of entropy, the modern concept of entropy, but he recognized that he had the fundamentals of it. He recognized that it's natural for a physical system to run down or break down over time, which is the effect of entropy. And so so death is natural unless a natural system is propped up by grace. And so if you're going to be immortal, you need to be propped up by grace. Otherwise, your body would naturally run down and break down and die. And the same thing is true here. If you're a heterotroph like we are, a heterotroph is something that can't make its own nutrients, so you have to eat something else. It's going to be natural for you to have waste products from your consumption of nutrients. Okay. And so if there is eating in heaven, and there are certainly passages that depict heaven as a big banquet, and if those are to be taken literally, then there would be waste naturally in heaven unless God chooses to do something above nature, something supernatural, like make us perfect extractors of nutrients so we have total conversion of matter to energy. In which case there wouldn't be any waste because we've become little, not just nuclear reactors, but basically almost antimatter reactors where we can consume the entirety of the energy in the food we eat. And there would be nothing left at all once we extract the energy. So God could do that, but unless he does that, there would be waste. Or he could make it so we don't need to eat. He could give us energy directly, in which case there might not be eating. Or he could do some other kind of miracle. He could have us eat, maybe just for fun and, you know, for the enjoyment of it, and then annihilate the waste before it leaves our bodies. So there are various possibilities here. There is a verse in 1 Corinthians that says, you know, the stomach is made for food and food for the stomach, but God will destroy them both. And that could be, I'm not saying at all that it is, that could just be a reference to death, but it also could be a sign that we won't need to eat in the afterlife, in the resurrection. And so if that's the case, then the heavenly banquet may be more of a spiritual reality and not a literal banquet. And in that case, if we're getting the energy we need some other way, some supernatural way, there might not be eating and there might not be pooping. But unless God intervenes supernaturally to alter the way we get our energy and alter the eating process, then there would be pooping in heaven. But it would be really great pooping.
Because it's heavenly. It would literally be heavenly. As a matter of fact,
no everything constipation in heaven or anything like that.
I'm so glad we got that question, Philip. Thank you very, very much. Now, here comes something that I think of as this is the kind of thing I think of when I think of weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Although it's all fun, this comes right down to it. I don't know if this was covered already. I love it that Felix, who asked this, doesn't know if we covered this already, because here's the question. Does the just war doctrine still apply in a zombie apocalypse? What kind of weapons, strategies, and tactics are justified in it?
Well, okay, so morally speaking, the just war doctrine is mandated not just because of the rights of the people that are your enemies in a war. Mm-hmm. It does protect their rights, but it's also mandated because of our human nature, and it's a misuse of our human nature to do certain things, including in wartime, like killing innocents. And so the principles of the just war theory would still apply in a general way in a zombie apocalypse, because you have non-zombies who are dealing with the outbreak of zombie violence, and their human natures require them to act in a moral manner. But the question is, so the principles will apply in a general way, but the question is, how will they apply specifically to the zombies as aggressors? Well, one of the things we're assuming here is that the zombies are no longer rational moral agents. You know, they're undead. They are not really, they're not rational. They are just irrationally aggressive. You could think of them, you could even think of a zombie apocalypse as a massive rabies outbreak, where rabies, you know, it deprives someone of reason, it makes them aggressive, the virus wants to spread itself by causing you to bite other people or have intimate relations with other people, and that's how the virus spreads itself. And so you could think of a zombie virus as if it's a massive, highly communicable form of rabies. Well, okay, if you're not dealing with rational moral agents as your enemy, then that will affect things. For example, there's not going to be an obligation to try to negotiate with them. You know, because they're not capable of negotiation. And so that, which is something that ordinarily you would have before you can even engage in hostilities, you know, try to resolve the conflict without violence, that's out the window, because they're just aggressors. They're not capable of negotiation. You can use aggression immediately to respond. Then there's the question of, are zombies really dead? If they're really dead and they're just reanimated corpses,
mm-hmm.
then they're reanimated corpses. And you can do anything to them that you need to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there will be a certain minimal respect for the dead that needs to be shown, and respect for their remains, but that really doesn't apply if their remains are attacking you.
Yeah.
And if their remains are attacking you, you can do anything to, because it's just a physical object. It is not a living person. And consequently, the application of the just war rules would be fairly minimal, because there are no innocents in this. An innocent means a non-aggressor. And if you have a zombie apocalypse, they are all aggressors. And so use of lethal force against them is warranted. Then what if they're not dead? What if it's like the rabies example I mentioned? You know, they've got this virus, they're still alive, they're just irrationally aggressive. Well, then the next question is going to be, can they be cured? Now, rabies, once you've contracted it and once it's gone to your central nervous system, there is no cure. You need to catch rabies earlier than that. That's why if someone gets bit by a rabid dog, they need to start taking rabies shots immediately. If they're not curable, then you have more liberty in terms of applying lethal force to them. But suppose it's not exactly like rabies, suppose it's possible to cure someone, okay, then there's a big new restriction on what you can do to them. If you're absolutely forced to kill a zombie in order to defend yourself or others, well, then you could kill them just like you could a normal person. If a normal person is attacking you or others and the only way to save their lives is to kill the aggressor, you can kill the aggressor. But if the zombies are curable, then you need to take that into account, and you need to, if possible, not kill them, but contain them until such time as you can get them the cure. And finally, you know, it's going to depend on if the zombies can be safely housed and humanely treated post-apocalypse, even if they're not curable, which is based on the size of the threat.
Felix, what a great question to end the first hour of Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We got another hour coming, and we've got more than an hour's worth of questions and lots of great ones to come. So hang on. We're not taking calls today. We're just doing these pre-submitted weird questions. But Jimmy will be back for another hour and more weird questions to come right after this on Catholic Answers Live.